You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. You are listening to the evening news. KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Friends of KBOO, supporting locally produced, organically grown, homemade programming for Portland and the world. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
Responding to listener and community requests, we are engaging in a trial period of broadcasting the Tom Hartman Show from 4 to 5 p.m. each weekday. We take seriously the feedback we have received from listeners, non-listeners, KBOO members, and volunteers. This trial period is both an attempt to present the program, which is currently unavailable on broadcast media in the Portland area, and to solicit feedback on how appropriate this program is for KBOO. Please call 503-231-8032 or write to program@kboo.org with your opinion.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Multnomah County Health Department released a plan that identifies the local health impacts of climate change.
A hearing today in Vancouver tackles the debate over a coal export terminal on the Columbia River.
The United Nations is being sued over the deadly cholera epidemic in Haiti.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 9th, 2013. I'm Jemai Cherry.
And I'm Aaron J. Bernard. The federal government shutdown continued today for the ninth straight day, while House Majority Leader John Boehner continues to refuse to allow the House to vote on a spending bill. President Obama is currently meeting with House Democrats to discuss the budget situation and the upcoming debt deadline. The president has invited the full House Republican conference to the White House tomorrow for a discussion on ways to end the government shutdown. However, Speaker Boehner announced that a much smaller group, made up of the House Republican leadership, would attend with the intent of resolving the impasse. Senator Patty Murray from Washington State is one of those who spoke today on the Senate floor demanding an end to the impasse.
Madam President, I served on the Super Committee. I worked with my colleagues to write and pass our budget here in the Senate. I know Democrats and Republicans have some serious differences when it comes to our budget values and our priorities. And I absolutely believe we owe it to the American people to try to bridge that divide, to find common ground. But are we really going to ask them to wait patiently, continue suffering through this shutdown, keep watching as we cruise towards an economic calamity while another super committee gets together and has a conversation? Madam President, that does not make sense. Let's have those conversations. Let's have those negotiations. But let's end this crisis and get to work. Now, yesterday I heard something from the Speaker. He said he didn't want to end the shutdown or address the debt limit now because that would be, quote, unconditional surrender to the President. Madam President, have we really come to the point where simply allowing the government to open is considered by one party to be a political loss? Are we really in a place where the majority of one chamber in one branch of government believes allowing the United States of America to pay its bills is a major concession? Madam President, the great American system that we hold so dear, our democracy that is the envy of the world, simply cannot work if a minority of members can threaten to shut down the government or devastate the economy if they don't get their way on an issue.
Madam President, I want to thank the Senator from Washington for the 21st time coming to the floor of the United States Senate and asking the Republicans to join us in a conference committee to resolve our budget differences between the House and the Senate. 21 times Senator Murray has come to this floor simply asking to negotiate. And the Republicans, who have been arguing that we don't negotiate, turned her down 21 times, the latest by the senior senator from Texas. The junior senator from Texas shut down the government over the notion of defunding Obamacare. Now the senior senator from Texas has said he objects to going to a conference committee to resolve our differences, Republicans and Democrats, between the House and the Senate. If we are going to restore this Senate to the orderly process, what the senator from Washington has asked for is very basic. Open the government.
That was Senator Dick Durbin following a statement by Washington Senator Patty Murray on ending the government shutdown.
The threat of a U.S. default on national debt could have a devastating global impact, according to a statement today by the World Bank. The president of the bank, Jim Yong Kim, today said that U.S. default could hurt emerging markets and developing nations. Jim cited the long-term market impact from the last time the U.S. approached defaulting on its debt in August 2011. Markets in developing countries dropped, hurting not only large corporations, but also small business owners and farmers. Jim said the World Bank, a Washington-based financial institution that provides loans to developing countries, plans to decrease extreme poverty by half within the next 7 years. But the World Bank's loan terms and its links to the International Monetary Fund, which require poor countries to engage in severe austerity measures, have long been criticized by advocates for the poor around the world. At the same time, some of the world's wealthiest investors have placed bets against the government in the form of credit default swaps, which will pay off the government if the government does go into default.
Today, supporters of the Millennium Bulk Terminal and its opponents met at the Clark County Fairgrounds to discuss the future of coal exportation in the Willamette Gorge. Proponents hope that the bulk terminal will create jobs for the area, while opponents worry for the state of the environment at home and abroad. The debate centered on how large of an area of effect the government would survey before allowing the project. Speakers from both sides took turns at the podium above a sea of people wearing red and blue t-shirts, representing their stance on the issue. KBOO reporter Peter Schoaf recorded the following speeches this afternoon.
Tom Hartman here on the news. You need to know this. On Tuesday, President Obama spoke at length about the looming debt limit deadline.
Jim Washburn from Clark County. Coal trains coming through the gorge is not a new thing, I don't believe. There's a coal-fired powerhouse in Centralia, Washington, that's been burning coal for probably ever since I came here in 1973. So, seems to me, if coal trains coming through the gorge were harming the environment, it seems like that somebody in the Department of Ecology would have shut that down right out the gate. Okay? We've had coal trains coming through the gorge for a long time. And the same logic that people are using to discourage the Millennium Bulk Terminal is okay with hundreds of trains, trucks, and tugboats carrying garbage from Washington, from Portland, and Vancouver area up to through the gorge, the Columbia River National Scenic Area. Okay? You're okay with running trains and barges and trucks up through the gorge to haul garbage out of here, which is taking jobs with it, but you're not okay with bringing coal trains to Longview that's going to provide 2,650 construction jobs, probably 12,000 people are going to be have a better standard of living because of this. You're going to have 300 permanent jobs that's going to provide probably 1,200-1,500 people with a better standard of living. The coal trains is nothing new. Department of Ecology knows how much environmental damage these coal trains are causing. And it's my contention that the amount of jobs that's going to be generated by this project and the amount of taxes that's going to come into Clark County and Cowlitz County and state of Oregon, state of Washington, I mean, outweighs any type of environmental damage that's going to come from these trains coming through here. It's nothing new. The government knows if these trains are bad or not. And if they were bad, if they're bad now, they've been bad, and they should have been shut down a long time ago. But if they're not bad, they should be considered, they should be allowed to run, and they should be allowed to build this project in Longview and provide those jobs for working people. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
My name is Linda Horst. I reside in Kelso. Millennium states they will be a good neighbor. A curious statement, considering the neighborhood they selected has five substations, the largest being the Bonneville Power Administration's 230,000-volt sub, which adjoins the coal terminal. BPA cannot function efficiently, economically, or safely with coal dust as a constant issue plaguing their facility. It's a known fact that carbon in coal dust conducts electricity. Oregon's PGE made this very clear in their opposition to the coal terminal at Port Westward. This private company stated that the coal dust would be a substantial problem for their equipment. Because of BPA's proximity to the 44 million annual tons of coal dust stored in four immense open piles, they will receive the brunt of this insidious conductive dust. Westerly winds will carry this invasive dust, covering and sweeping it into highly intricate and extensive equipment. This can cause numerous types of electrical malfunctions. Some may be as brief as a power bump, causing Weyerhaeuser a costly couple of seconds, or as large and damaging as a loss of power, equipment, fire, explosion, or injury to employees. While dust is a major issue, so too is access. The mile-and-a-half coal trains slithering through Longview 16 times a day will block BPA's only access every 1.5 hours. This is a logistic and safety nightmare. Longview Sub plays an integral part of the massive Northwest power grid. I urge the three agencies here today to please ensure that we can continue to receive safe and reliable public power unencumbered by coal for China and profits for Australia. Thank you.
Yes, Aaron.
Those are the voices of two speakers at the fairgrounds hearing. For more, we now go live to KBOO reporter Jimmy Tardy, who is attending today's hearing. Jimmy, what's happening right now?
Hey, thank you. Yes, I'm here at the Clark County Fairgrounds, just on the northern part of Vancouver, Washington. We're here for a scoping hearing that's being held by the state of Washington. And the question today here is, what will be the extent of the environmental impact assessment that the state will do regarding the proposed Millennium Bulk Terminal in Longview. I'm here. I'm joined by Jeff Washburn, who is with the Longview Kelso Building Council. And I'm also speaking with Rick Marshall, who is representing Beyond Coal. I've talked with both of them. They've agreed to give a short introduction into their standpoint and what brought them out here today. We flipped a coin, and I'm going to go first to Jeff Washburn, and he's going to share with us why he's in support of the proposed Millennium facility in Longview, Washington. Jeff?
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. First thing I'd like to say is I like to listen to KBOO in my spare time when I can, especially the blues show you have. The reason I'm in support of Millennium, the big reason is, in the labor community, we have a hard time finding partners to buy into our living wage jobs and into our apprenticeship programs. When Millennium came to town, they came right over and started talking to us at the building trades about the project coming up. And we've entered into a project labor agreement, and the project labor agreement is an all-union agreement, so there's going to be a lot of living wage jobs provided during the construction. And also a lot of the materials and everything for the project are going to be sourced locally. That's another boon to the local economy. So Millennium has been a good partner for organized labor to try and help keep and maintain living wage jobs and keep our apprenticeship moving as well for opportunities for the future.
That's Jeff Washburn. He's in support of the proposed Millennium Terminal in Longview. And now I'm speaking with Rick Marshall, who's with Beyond Coal Exports. Rick, what's your take on this?
Yeah, so we would like to see as broad of a scope as possible. We'd like to see the impacts of this export proposal all the way from mine to port considered. I'm from Camas, Washington. I have a lot of family in Camas. And we're a rail community, and there's dozens of rail communities up and down from Longview to Montana. The impacts on those communities should be considered, both from a health aspect and an economic viewpoint. We do not benefit from this export proposal in any way. My dad lives a block and a half from the railroad tracks in downtown Camas. Got a lung disease. We know that coal dust comes off of these trains. We know that there's going to be a lot more diesel exhaust. And this isn't going to help him in any way. And that's just one person who's vulnerable along the tracks. There's many others. And those impacts need to be considered. Anytime you look at something, economic issue, you got to do a full accounting, both the costs and the benefits.
So there you have a brief snapshot of some of the viewpoints being expressed here today. The folks that are in support of the Millennium Bulk Terminal in Longview, Washington, are kind of focusing on the jobs aspect, the economic boon to the area. The Beyond Coal Exports Group is tending to focus more on the environmental impacts. And as Rick was mentioning, they're pushing for a scoping, which will include everything from the mine to the port, and a recent development has been that the state of Washington, in some of their scoping efforts recently, have agreed to include those aspects and beyond, including climate change that occurs as a result of the burning of fossil fuels, including the coal that's in question.
Thank you, Jimmy. That was KBOO's Jimmy Tardy reporting live from the Clark County Fairgrounds in Vancouver, Washington. Cleaning up the 56 million gallons of nuclear waste left over at Washington's Hanford nuclear site is a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. In this case, that somebody is the U.S. Department of Energy, which announced today that it may need far longer than previously anticipated to complete the chore. The USDE says it is at serious risk of failing to meet milestones in the construction of a treatment plant intended to permanently contain a passel of highly radioactive material at the mostly decommissioned site. The federal government built Hanford along the Columbia River in the 1940s and used the facility for producing plutonium and conducting experiments related to the atomic bomb. Today, Hanford is the country's most polluted nuclear site. The USDE must clean and contain the mess at Hanford by 2022, according to an agreement reached between Washington State and the federal agency in 2010. The most recent round of delays may put that finish date in jeopardy. The 2010 agreement came out of a lawsuit filed against the Energy Department by Washington State after the USDE repeatedly missed previous cleanup deadlines. The plan sets target dates for activities including the tearing down of contaminated structures, the treating of contaminated water, and the emptying of leaky radioactive waste tanks. The construction of the containment facility is expected to cost more than $12 billion federal dollars. So far, the federal government has sunk more than $40 billion into cleanup efforts at Hanford.
A Canadian woman will be in court tomorrow in Portland to change her plea from not guilty to guilty in an eco-sabotage case. The government has called the case of Rebecca Rubin and her fellow activists the most extensive eco-terrorism case in U.S. history. Rebecca Rubin is charged with over a dozen counts for her participation in a series of arsons linked to the Earth Liberation Front in 1997 and 98. These include the burning of the Vail Ski Resort in Colorado and the freeing of wild horses in Burns, Oregon. Rubin turned herself in at the Canadian border last November in a prearranged deal with her attorney. Tomorrow, Rubin will plead guilty to 12 charges of arson and conspiracy, in the hope that Judge Ann Aiken will consider a reduced sentence. Rubin's lawyer says he is hoping she will receive a sentence of 5 to 8 years or less. The fact that Rubin lived for 10 years without committing any crimes will likely work in her favor. But the judge has a good deal of discretion in determining the length of the sentence. After tomorrow's plea change hearing, Rubin will remain in prison until a sentencing hearing in 3 months.
The Multnomah County Health Department released a report today on the impacts of climate change on public health in the county. The report predicts that poor people, senior citizens, and ethnic minorities will be disproportionately impacted by climate change in Multnomah County. KBOO's Ken Jones spoke with Carrie Lyons Eubanks, who led a team of stakeholders in a three-year-long process to compile the report.
This is Ken Jones at KBOO News. I'm here with Carrie Lyons Eubanks. She's Multnomah County's Environmental Health Policy Analyst. And Carrie, you've just finished a report, Climate Change and Public Health Preparation Plan, and that was released today?
It was.
It took about 3 years to write?
It did take about 3 years. Well, the actual process itself was 3 years. So in our local climate, city-county climate action plan, there's 8 specific focus areas. Several of them are about reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, but number 7 is called preparation. And under that, we're sort of mandated, as because it's a city-county policy, to assess vulnerabilities, both population and geographical vulnerabilities to climate change, develop a plan, and monitor and evaluate it. So we started a 5-step process back in 2009, 10-ish, with 4 other local health departments around the state of Oregon as a cohort working with the Oregon Health Authority to understand what it meant to actually conduct a vulnerability assessment, because it's kind of a complex, confusing word. We didn't know where to start.
And what kind of research went into it then over the past few years?
So the first step was actually trying to look at climate modeling, and we worked with our city, county, stakeholders in like the County Office of Sustainability, the Portland Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, Bureau of Environmental Services, other offices, to actually look at the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute climate models and to try to understand it. Because some models say, 0.5 degrees, so much precipitation. And it was really kind of challenging to say, how do we think about what climate change means to us as, community members, residents, citizens of Multnomah County and the city of Portland, when it's really hard to understand what that actually means. And so the first step was just saying, we're going to keep it simple. We're going to have hotter, drier summers. We're going to have warmer, wetter winters. We're going to have more extreme heat days. And once we kind of made it that simple, it was really easy to kind of get together with stakeholders and say, what does that mean for health disparities? So we looked at, baseline data. So current rates of asthma, looking at hives, eczema, looking at current vector control populations and where we gather them. And if we had increased precipitation and increased spikes of heat, what would that mean for, mosquitoes blooming? And looking at a lot of air quality data through the Department of Environmental Quality and kind of bringing in a lot of data we already had access to, but kind of telling it in a story about climate change and what that might mean for our future, for example.
So the report actually outlines a lot of the possible effects of global warming. It seems like there's certain things we can do to prepare then? Is that part of the report or is that kind of the next step?
No, the report identifies, this particular report looks at increased temperatures, increased precipitation, more extreme heat days, and increase in vector-borne disease. And then we kind of lay out about 4 to 8 strategies. So, for example, with extreme heat, we are going to be working with social service providers that work with the elder community to get information out to elders, to look at who might be socially isolated and how do we check in on elders that might not be connected to community or family or friends. We're looking at trying to improve green spaces by partnering with, you know, city agencies and community-based organizations so that we can increase, you know, tree canopy, forestry, tree planting. For air quality, we're looking at high ozone days and how we could work with faith-based institutions and schools on, you know, kids with asthma and playing outside on those days and how can we mitigate exacerbations. So we have a lot of these sort of, you know, interventions that are pretty standard nationwide. But the key step now is actually working with community members to develop specific strategies for getting, you know, heat prevention messages out that work for different community members. How we work with the elder population is going to be different than how we work with, for example, people that speak English as a second language in the, you know, Cully neighborhood. We were, you know, just out there and had a great conversation with community members about, you know, coming together and figuring out how do we do culturally specific, culturally appropriate messaging to the community there that's really concerned about this issue kind of work.
Oh, well, thanks very much, Carrie.
Sure.
We've been talking with Carrie Lyons Eubanks, and she's Multnomah County's environmental health policy analyst. Again, Carrie, thanks for coming to KBOO and talking with us about
it. You're welcome. Thanks very much for having me. Yeah. It's a great issue that we should definitely keep paying attention to.
Two local nonprofit organizations received grants from the City of Portland today. Cash Oregon and Janus Youth Programs were both awarded $75,000 grants at the City Council meeting. The grant to Cash Oregon is to provide financial education, counseling, and tax preparation to low-income families. The group hosts free tax preparation sessions throughout the city during tax season. The grant to Janus Youth Programs will support its 2-year-old Village Market grocery store. Village Market aims to provide fresh, healthy, and affordable produce in the New Columbia neighborhood in North Portland, an area that many residents consider a food desert. A matching grant of $75,000 will be given to Village Market from Multnomah County. Janus Youth Programs came under fire earlier this year for fighting staff attempts at unionization. That unionization campaign is still ongoing.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Following this newscast, KBOO's Paul Rowland will be interviewing Sylvia McAdam, a First Nation member and one of the founders of the Idle No More movement, followed by Right to Survive at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is forecast to be partly cloudy with a below-average temperature of 59 degrees.
It's 5:28, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Carlyle called economics the dismal science, but he was only half right. Dismal, yes, but a science, no. It's more like religions, where reality is shaped by belief or blind faith. And in the case of free market zealots, it can turn into a cult. Thus, we see them pointing these days to the dazzling light of the soaring stock market, proclaiming fervently that Wall Street's spectacular rise from the ashes of the Great Recession is proof from the god of Mammon that these are boom times. Lo, the magic of the marketplace is upon us. No, it's just the wizardry of the Fed. For 5 years, America's central bank regulators have been funneling 2 massive subsidies into Wall Street banks and giant corporations in an ungodly effort to keep them flush, while praying that they might use these government windfalls to create a job or two. The first subsidy essentially amounts to giving $85 billion every month to big banks. Yes, $85 billion. The idea is that this capital will then be channeled into investments that nourish our grassroots economy. In practice, however, bankers are putting it into gimmicky, high-risk investment schemes that create nothing, into buyouts to expand their already too-big-to-fail empires, and into even heftier paychecks for themselves. The second subsidy is the Fed's relentless policy of artificially holding interest rates close to zero. This has severely punished middle-class retirees who count on getting interest incomes from their savings. But it has been a blessing from on high for huge corporations wanting to buy out their competitors or, in a totally unproductive bit of marketplace voodoo, to buy out themselves. This is Jim Hightower saying, meanwhile, the Fed's tinkle-down monetary policy has produced a truly dismal level of job creation and a hellishly wide chasm of inequality.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A police department in Texas is no longer using tasers, at least temporarily, due to confusion over a manufacturer's warning about the lethal nature that devices can have on people. The Mansfield Police Department and several other North Texas cities have decided they need to review their policies for use of the tasers, or stun guns, and whether or not they should continue to use them. Mansfield Police Chief Gary Fowler says he banned the tasers 3 weeks ago because he was uncomfortable with the heightened factory warnings that were issued for the devices. Fowler is quoted as saying, "We still have other tools out there, but this one tool, I believe it's in the best interest of the officers not to use any longer." A spokesperson from Taser Inc. says that the warnings are nothing new, but that they had just reposted them on the website in March. Steve Tuttle is a spokesperson for Taser, and he states that it was a miscommunication and that the internet led to misinformation about the warnings, which he says is not true.
Capital punishment is legal in 32 states, but the majority of death penalty executions are taking place in just a few U.S. counties. That's according to a new report from Death Penalty Information Center, which has found that half of all death penalty cases leading to execution originate in 62 counties across the United States. At the top of the list for executions are Philadelphia County, Pennsylvania, and Maricopa County, Arizona. 7 of the 10 additional counties with the highest execution rates are located in Texas, while more than half of the nation's death row inmates can be found in just 5 California counties. The report calls into question the conduct of some district attorneys who have the power to decide whether to seek death penalty for cases originating in their counties. Former Maricopa County District Attorney Andrew Thomas was sending four times the number of inmates to death row as his counterparts in Los Angeles and Houston before he was disbarred in 2012 for misconduct. Counties that use the death penalty the most also have some of the highest reversal rates for death penalty cases, the study found. One of the report's other findings is the fact that 85% of U.S. counties haven't had a single case resulting in execution in 45 years. The center says the findings raise serious questions of unequal and arbitrary application of the law. Capital punishment remains legal in Oregon, although a moratorium on executions has been placed since 2011. There are currently 37 inmates on Oregon's death row.
The Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti has filed a class action lawsuit against the United Nations for their role in the cholera outbreak. That outbreak has killed more than 8,000 and sickened more than 500,000 people in the island nation of Haiti since October of 2010. KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with the International Director of Communications at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, Dan Beaton, about the legal action as well as the pileup of studies and reports indicating the UN has a responsibility to the plaintiffs.
The suit was filed by attorneys with the Institute for Justice and Democracy on Haiti. It's actually a class action lawsuit. It was filed on behalf of 5 Haitians and Haitian Americans. And the idea is that other victims can join the suit against the United Nations. There's been 8,300 people in Haiti who've died from cholera already, and another 676,000 people who've been sickened. So there's quite a few people who've either directly contracted the disease itself or have been affected because family members have been sickened and or died from it.
Now, the cholera outbreak, it occurs in October of 2010, but it was brought to the land of Haiti via relief workers from Nepal. hired by the United Nations. Is that correct?
Well, actually, they were not relief workers. These were UN troops. So it was actually troops from Nepal who came in. They were not screened prior to their arrival in Haiti for cholera, even though there's cholera in Nepal in areas where these exact soldiers were coming from. And so that's part of the lawsuit. It's a clear case of criminal negligence, in my opinion.
Well, furthermore, they built their encampment for these troops right near the primary waterway for the country.
That's right. Yeah, the Artibonite River, and it's a major waterway in Haiti and provides drinking water to many hundreds of thousands of people. And so it was enormously negligent for these soldiers to dump sewage into the river, which is what they seem to have done. There is a cholera eradication plan that was put out by the Haitian and Dominican governments, which the United Nations helped to draft, in which the United Nations is supposed to be raising money for, but less than 10% of the funds. It's about $2.2 billion are estimated would be needed to fund this plan to eradicate the cholera. Less than 10% of that has been committed so far. So that's just not adequate, and that's also something that's in this lawsuit. In fact, that's the only real monetary damages that are named specifically is the $2.2 billion to actually force the UN to fund this plan.
Can you describe the legal systems and nuances at an international level? What court is it that can hold an entity like the United Nations accountable?
Well, that's actually somewhat of something that seems to be under debate, and I'm not an attorney, so this is something that the groups that filed the lawsuit today are hoping that because it's New York, which is where, of course, the UN is headquartered, and also because there's a number of Haitian Americans in the community there, that the court might rule that it does have jurisdiction over this case and actually pursue the damages against the United Nations. There's been 10 different scientific studies that have found the, if not an identical match of the cholera strain with that in Nepal, of other very damning evidence that shows that there really is UN responsibility here. So this is not really in question among the scientific community.
I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
For more details and historical information on the lawsuit, visit the website of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti at ijdh.org.
Russian investigators upped the ante today in the piracy case against the so-called Greenpeace 30, a group of 28 activists and two filmmakers arrested last month after protesting oil drilling in the Russian Arctic. Prosecutors say hard drugs, including raw opium and morphine, were discovered during a search of the Greenpeace ship, the Arctic Sunrise, which the activists had been aboard. The environmental group dismissed the claim as a smear and a fabrication and said the organization has a strict zero-tolerance policy for recreational drugs aboard its vessels. The group claimed the only pharmaceuticals on board the ship were medical supplies contained in a safe smashed by the Russians. For more, Simon Marks spoke to correspondent Daria Bondarchuk in Moscow and started by asking her when the drugs were allegedly discovered on the Greenpeace ship.
We do not know the exact date, but what we do know is that formally as of September 19, the ship has been under the control of the Federal Security Service and the Investigative Committee. The crew was barred from controlling it and arrested. Now, Russian investigators claim they have found poppy stem and morphine on board the arrested vessel. Greenpeace International calls the claims a pure fabrication. It published a statement saying the substances found may refer to the medical supplies that the crew is obliged to carry under maritime law. In particular, the presence of morphine is obligatory in medical kits on vessels traveling under the Dutch laws. The ship was first inspected by Russian officers weeks ago, and earlier today the lawyer for Greenpeace Russia, Mikhail Kraydlin, noted that ever since the arrest of the Arctic Sunrise vessel, it has no definite status. It was towed to and is docked at the port of Murmansk. The Greenpeace says the icebreaker is still controlled by identified people, and since there's no crew on board, basically anything can be found.
So is it possible that these claims could lead to the Greenpeace 30 facing fresh charges in addition to the piracy charges that they're already facing?
Well, yes, there is such a risk. It could be possible that the authorities are looking for a way to reformulate charges and bring new ones in addition or in place of piracy charges already put against the detained activists. The Russian Investigative Committee also hinted that the Greenpeace activists could be held liable for making an attempt on the life and health of the border guards during the seizure.
And how is the plight of the Greenpeace activists playing publicly in Russia? Is it front page news there? And how are people in Moscow viewing this case?
Well, not quite exactly the front page, but yes, of course, the media is closely following the developments. Fresh reports came out today from the city of Murmansk. We know that the defense team of several foreign members of the Arctic Sunrise crew, citizens of Argentina, Italy, and two British citizens, has filed an appeal against their arrest. Yesterday, the court has already rejected similar appeals filed against the arrest of the freelance Russian photographer Denis Sinyakov, who was covering the story. And we also know that bail requests for the remaining 27 activists are expected to be heard later this week. So it looks like they will have to remain in custody for a while now. The maximum deadline we know is until November 24.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, October 9, 2013. Israeli troops invade West Bank communities, injure a civilian, and kidnap seven others. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Dozens of Israeli soldiers invaded the northern West Bank city of Jenin on Wednesday at dawn, shot and injured one Palestinian. Clashes have been reported. Soldiers also installed roadblocks in the area and invaded various communities. Medical sources said that Muhammad Ashour Zakarna, 20, was shot by a gas bomb in the leg during clashes that took place in the city. He was moved to the Jenin governmental hospital, suffering moderate injuries. Also Wednesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers invaded various areas in the occupied West Bank, including occupied East Jerusalem, and kidnapped several Palestinians, including a 12-year-old child. Local sources reported army invasions and kidnappings in Al-Izariya town near occupied East Jerusalem, Tel Village west of the northern West Bank city of Nablus, and Beit Umar town north of the southern West Bank city of Hebron, as well as Beit Jala town in the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem. In other news, Israeli sources announced on Wednesday that the Israeli government has approved the construction of 58 new homes for settlers in Jerusalem. According to the sources, the District Committee for Planning and Building in the Israeli Jerusalem municipality have approved the new homes to be built in the illegal Pisgat Ze'ev settlement in East Jerusalem. The Palestinian President Office issued a statement on Wednesday condemning the new wave of construction and deemed it as an obstacle to the peace efforts and go against all international laws. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, October 9, 2013, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please keep visiting our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, a suicide bomb attack killed three Afghan police officers in the Helmand province this morning. Investigators believe the police vehicle was the bomb's target. According to Afghan officials, two other police officers and two civilians were killed in subsequent fighting following the attack. A Taliban group has claimed responsibility for the bombing. Joint security forces executed an operation to clear an eastern province of insurgents. According to a statement released by the Afghan military, the ongoing raid has killed 20 insurgents so far. 10 arrests have been made, and no civilian casualties have been reported. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, Ken Jones, Aaron J. Bernard, Peter Schoaf, and Jimmy Chardy. The producer is Jemai Cherry. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Jemai Cherry. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, it's the beginning of our fall membership drive. At 7, hear Democracy Now! With award-winning journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Joanne Hardesty guests on Voices from the Edge is the irrepressible investigative journalist Greg Pallast. At 9, hear Press Watch, News You're Not Supposed to Know with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, on A Deeper Look, host Linda Olson Osterlund interviews author and legal activist Heidi Bogosian about her book on spying on democracy, government surveillance, corporate power, and public resistance. At 10, hear Eric Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 is Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, it's the guest. The guest is Seattle naturalist Leandy Lynn Hout, the author of The Urban Estuary, Bestiary, Encountering the Everyday Wild. And at 11:30 on Words and Pictures, the guest is Dennis Eichhorn of Real Stuff Comics. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. It's our membership drive starting tomorrow, so please feel free to contribute.
Well, listeners, you may have heard my voice before. Portland wouldn't be what it is today without KBOO Radio. KBOO Radio has brought people together through the airwaves in an interactive process that has allowed Portland to become a richer, more vibrant, more progressive city. A city that let go of a freeway along what is now Waterfront Park. A city that has an activist community, whether it's for bike lanes or fancy food or whatever it is. KBOO has been part of the cultural underpinning of all that we have become together. Yep, you've heard me before. I'm Vicky Tempe. Now Victoria Stapiello. I was a station manager when we built our studios in the early 1980s. All I did then was pitch for money so that we could do this debt-free. We own our own home. We have no mortgage. Not my doing, but all of our doing. We need you to continue to support KBOO as a vibrant, healthy underlayment for all that we build in our community. Well, listeners, you may have heard my voice before. Portland wouldn't be what it is today without KBOO Radio.
And hello, this is Paul Rowland, and this is the interview segment for the end of the KBOO News, since Free Speech Radio News is no longer being broadcast. On the phone with me, I have Sylvia McAdam from Saskatchewan, Canada. I believe you're there. Hello, Sylvia.
Hi. Yeah.
So how are you doing? How's the weather up there?
It's really quite nice. The leaves are turning, of course. We always have a very deep yellow in terms of color out here, but it's very beautiful.
So you have become known as one of the initiators of the I Don't Know More movement, if you can call it that, which swept across Canada and across the United States even, and some places around the world. In December of last year, in reaction to a very sweeping legislation that really changed the relationship between the Canadian government and the First Nations peoples, and led to the expansion, allowed the expansion of tar sands mining and more pipelines to carry it, and a number of other things that have negatively impacted First Nations communities. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what's gone on since then, and also why there was a call to action again this past Monday, October 7th.
Well, there's been significant goings-on, like you mentioned, that really dramatically changes the landscape for Canadian citizens as well as Indigenous people in Canada. And one of those that triggered I Don't Know More was Bill C-45. And that's only the first bill. There's 9 bills that are going through the Canadian Parliament. I think there's 5 left now that are waiting to be put through. Now, what makes this whole process so dramatic and so horrible is that it's unheard of that an omnibus budget bill, Bill C-45, could even speak to the topic of changing treaty lands for Indigenous people, but that's exactly what it did. And not only that, it was introduced in October and passed into law December 14th, which that alone is a precedent-setting time frame. It's unheard of that such a huge bill, which is 450 pages long, could go through Parliament in such a short time frame. And now the other bills directly impact Indigenous lands in terms of making it easier. The threshold of consent has been lowered in every way possible in terms of Indigenous consent, in terms of environmental assessment. There's literally no environmental assessment now to access the waters and the lands, which opens up the pipelines and various other modes to access Indigenous territories. There's billions and billions of dollars worth of resources being extracted from Indigenous territories without the free, prior, and informed consent of Indigenous people. Absolutely not. And this is unceded territories. This is unceded lands, unceded resources, unceded waters. And the way this Conservative government is moving forward as if it's business as usual, it's just horrific on the impacts to environment. Now the tar sands are going to be expanded into the Treaty 6 territory, which means into Saskatchewan, which is closer to my people's lands. And that's frightening. It's really frightening. And they're also in English River and other areas out there where the Dene people, where their territory is, they're talking about nuclear waste storage, nope, which again will impact their lands and their territories and their water, most definitely their water. And people don't realize that Canada is one of the last states in the world that has fresh water, and it definitely will impact people globally.
Now, I just wanted to jump in because we don't have a whole lot of time here with this interview, but you've mentioned a number of things that probably our listeners are not that familiar with. You mentioned Treaty 6 and the whole nature of the different treaty areas in Canada, which we can't get into, but I urge our listeners to look into that some more. But the reason we're doing this interview is because there's a day of action was proclaimed for October 7th, and I just wanted to, I know we can't really get into the whole origins of the Royal Proclamation, but maybe you could just give us a quick take on why you chose this date.
We chose that date because the Royal Proclamation is a document that is the first to mention and recognize and affirm that indigenous people are nations. It's the first time that word nation is mentioned. And since its creation, it's been 250 years of broken promises. So in a way, we're not celebrating. We are not celebrating in any way. We were bringing to light the 250 years of broken promises, not honoring the treaties that are the foundation of Canada. Canada is a successor state of these treaties and a successor state to honoring the Royal Proclamation. As well, the other thing we chose October 7th is because the UN Special Rapporteur, James Anaya, is arriving in Canada to do an official visit to research and speak to Indigenous people and a situation here. Those are the two significant things that October 7th represented for us.
And in the time we have left, maybe you could just talk about some of the things. I noticed that in Montreal, the police reacted somewhat violently to an Idle No More protest. They took down and destroyed a teepee that had been set up. I'm wondering sort of what the relationship has been to the police in these various Idle No More. But more importantly for us, we spoke to you several months ago with some other guests, you know, soon after the Idle No More movement had taken off and had swept across Canada and really changed to some extent the conversation and the visibility of First Nations or Indigenous people in Canada. How has Idle No More developed, and how has it changed the conversation in Canada over these issues?
It really, what Idle No More did was it highlighted the situation of what Indigenous people are experiencing and enduring here on Turtle Island. We call it Turtle Island. It's now known as Canada, of course. It's highlighted the situation globally. And we still have to keep pressuring the government because, like I said, they're moving along like it's business as usual. It seems like they're all across the land. We're saying, no, don't do this. You do not have our consent, and a Canadian state is not listening. They're just plowing through as if we have no voice, and that's disheartening and discouraging. But at the same time, it's so powerful and empowering and beautiful, and just this collective voice all across our lands and our territories. For the first time, a movement is actually bringing people to hit the ground, to come out of their homes and to hit the ground and have a collective resistance. And it's brought attention to the environmental situation in Canada, and it's also brought attention to the ongoing racism and discrimination and systemic disparity of resources that Canada is imposing on Indigenous people. Like I said, we get no benefit at all from the resources that are being extracted, and people need to know that. People who are the U.S. citizens that are buying the so-called ethical oil, it is not ethical. I know that I've seen Oprah call it ethical. It's not ethical. This is being done without our consent, and we have no benefits from that. And even if we did get benefits, I would say we are against the way that the resources are being extracted. We can do better. We have the technology. We have all the alternative resources of energy. We need to start heading in that direction.
Now,
the way we are extracting the resources is the issue here.
Yeah,
Canada is the biggest destructive force in our climate in terms of tar sands and all the other activities that are happening and the development, the so-called development.
Yeah, and of course, I don't know how much people know that Canadian mining companies are some of the major forces all over the world in a lot of different mineral extractions, also in other indigenous lands in South America, and in the Pacific and other regions. Maybe in the minute we have left, you could just give us a sense of some of the actions that have been going on, some of the things that happened on Monday, some of the blockades that have been going on.
There was traffic slowdowns, and, you know, most of the time the police are really cooperative, so this is how come we're so disappointed in the actions of the police in Montreal. Overall, they've been trying to make an effort to make it safe for the events that have been happening, and also we've had rallies, we've had our ceremonial lodges raised up in prayer. We've had music festivals because the Voice of Idle No More is creative, it's prayerful, it's ceremonial, and it's powerful. And we've even had like spoken word poets come to the teach-ins. We call them teach-ins because our aim is to educate and let people know and let the world know that these Canadian corporations do not have our consent on our territories and anywhere else in the world.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up. Are there any sources on the web or elsewhere where people can go to learn more about what's going on in Canada with Idle No More, with what you're involved in?
You can go to our website, www.idlenomore.ca, and you could add your name to our list of emails that we mass email all of our people who are on our website, and so add your name to it. We'll send you, and we even have text messaging now.
Okay, well, listen, thank you very much, Sylvia, speaking to us from her home in Saskatchewan, and I've been speaking with Sylvia McAdam, born and raised on the Big River First Nations Reserve in Saskatchewan. She holds degrees in law and human justice and teaches at the First Nations University. She's one of four women who started the Idle No More movement in response to Canada's changes in the several major bills that have changed the whole relationship with the First Nations people. And I'm Paul Rowland, and this has been KBOO News. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7.